From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan gets subpar grades on the test called the Nation's Report Card.
I don't think anyone was expecting to see any significant improvement.
We'll hear from Democratic candidate for governor, Bill Cobbs.
You know, we've got to step back and realize that the Second Amendment does not mean that there is no regulation.
They helped the Detroit Red Wings win two Stanley Cups. A new film looks at what it took to bring the Russian Five to Detroit.
Those people could have been killed. Their families could have been threatened. You know, that's a very, very big thing on the line to leave under those circumstances. It was a scary time.
And what's with the snowy cold spring we're having?
Part of it is just your normal weather pattern of abnormally weird weather all around the globe. And we're in the pocket that's abnormally cold right now.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called the Nation's Report Card, a benchmark test that measures math and reading proficiency. And when it comes to the National Assessment of Educational Progress, Michigan students have nothing to brag about. The results of the 2017 NAEP are out. Scores for Michigan students were flat, virtually unchanged from the previous test in 2015, which puts Michigan students below the national average. And even worse news out of Detroit schools, where scores were the worst in the nation. Aaron Einhorn of Chalkbeat Detroit is with us now via Skype. Aaron, let's start with these statewide scores. What are the reasons being given for flat scores and still being well below the national average?
I think it's probably the better answer is why we're not seeing an increase. And that's because we're not seeing any major changes. So Michigan's scores have been flat or going down pretty steadily since Michigan started participating in the Nation's Report Card and the NAEP test. And in that time, we've funded schools pretty much the same. We've organized schools pretty much the same. We haven't made any changes. So I don't think anyone was expecting to see any significant improvement.
State School Superintendent Brian Whiston was on this program just a short time ago, and his message is basically, look, we've got our plans in place to make Michigan a top 10 state in 10 years, so let's let things play out. Let the plan work. Do these scores, these NAEP scores, support that tactic?
I mean, if the goal is to be in the top 10, then we have a long way to go. So Michigan students were 35th in the nation in fourth grade reading, 38th in fourth grade math, 33rd in eighth grade math, 30th in eighth grade reading. I mean, our fourth grade math scores are the lowest in the state's entire history of taking the exam. So it's certainly not trending in the right direction. I'm sure the state superintendent would point out that this test was taken about a year ago in the early part of 2017. So maybe if the test was given again today, it might be slightly higher. Maybe we'd see something different. But, you know, I haven't seen any major policy changes or anything that would tell me, okay, things are changing. We're headed toward that top 10.
Let's go to Detroit. And just to give everyone a sense of how things are, fourth grade math, 36% of students scored at or above proficient. Statewide in Detroit, it's 4%. Fourth grade reading, 32% statewide, 5% in Detroit. Eighth grade reading, 34% statewide at or above proficient, 7% in Detroit. And eighth grade math, 31% statewide, 5% in Detroit. And am I right? These scores are even lower than the 2015 NAEP test?
The fourth grade math score in particular is down 5 points over where it was in 2015. But actually, comparing Detroit to Michigan isn't necessarily the most informative thing to look at. So Detroit is part of a voluntary comparison between big city school districts that ranks, you know, New York and Denver and Memphis, all the big cities around the country that voluntarily agree to participate in a district comparison, because that's sort of, you know, it's a lot. It's more apples to apples than comparing a city to a state. And Detroit has been participating in that for 5 years. The test is given every other year. And the first year Detroit participated was 2009. And Detroit has been dead last in each of those 5 years.
And what reasons are we hearing from education experts for this performance?
Well, I mean, you know, Detroit is facing significant challenges that a lot of those other cities aren't facing. So we took a look at poverty rates in the 27 districts that are in that big city district comparison, and Detroit's poverty rate is the highest. Its median income is the lowest. So kids are facing challenges at home that might not be comparable to what kids in other districts are facing. But also, Detroit schools have seen years of turmoil. Now, this test was taken in the first 3 months of 2017, so right after the new school board, the first locally elected school board in years, took office. They were taken before Detroit got a new superintendent, who started in May of last year. So the scores kind of come at the end, or hopefully the end, of, you know, a kind of a revolving door of emergency managers. You know, their teachers were walking out over unsafe building conditions. You know, there have been financial challenges created by just enrollment, massive declines in enrollment that took money out of the district. They cut art, they cut music, they cut gym, they cut counselors, they cut all kinds of supports. And, you know, I don't think anybody was particularly surprised to see that Detroit remains, or at least in the early part of 2017, remained the bottom of the bottom.
And as you write in Chalkbeat Detroit, the test scores from Duval County Public Schools in Florida, where Nicolae Vitti was superintendent before coming to Detroit, could offer some hope for Detroiters. Tell us how he helped improve those scores in Jacksonville, Florida.
Well, we have to be careful because the people who run the NAEP test are pretty adamant that you can't say, okay, the score went up and that means that this policy worked or that educator, you know, did well, because lots of things go into a test score. You know, it isn't the same kids taking it from year to year. You know, it's fourth graders this year versus fourth graders next year. What we can say about Duval County, Florida, Jacksonville, is that the fourth graders who posted the highest math scores in the nation on that district comparison were in kindergarten when Nicolae Vitti took over the school district in Duval. So whatever happened with fourth grade math in that district, he can easily claim credit for that. You know, he noted to me in a statement that he gave yesterday that the curriculum that he was using in Duval to show that improvement is the same curriculum that he's planning to implement in Detroit.
Erin, it seems like a never-ending cycle of bad news for Michigan students and their test scores. You take assessment tests, scores disappoint, rinse and repeat. You talk to education experts all the time. What do you hear repeated most often as something that must change now for Michigan schools to improve?
Well, if you want to read a report that spells out detail by detail everything we need to do to improve schools in Michigan, I can send you, you know, I think Bridge Magazine compiled 12 of them. You know, there were all these reports and the governor did one and this coalition of education and business leaders did one. There's all these different reports. They all have lots of recommendations. But what I hear most from advocates, what they mostly are saying is, you know, what we need is leadership. We need someone to take one of these reports, take these recommendations, and implement them. And there's not a lot of that happening at the moment.
Erin Einhorn, Chalkbeat Detroit. Thanks so much, Erin.
Thanks for having me.
It has been spring for 22 days now, but snow is still falling. I had it all over my yard this morning. And just how normal are these chilly weather patterns, and how long can we expect them to last? Mark Torregrossa, chief meteorologist with MLive and farmerweather.com, is here now. Mark, we know the all-time record low for April in Michigan is minus 34 degrees, which happened April 1st, 1923 at the Bergland Dam in the Upper Peninsula. But I understand this past Sunday morning, the city of Stambaugh, also in the UP, recorded quite the low. How cold did it get?
I think they were down to about minus 24. So it was very cold for April.
Well, let's talk about the state. How much colder, Mark, is this April shaping up to be than previous, what we would say, more normal years?
Well, let's start off with what is normal. And normal is probably not a good word. The real word should be average, okay? So our average high temperature in southern Michigan, let's say the southern third of Michigan now, is in the mid to upper 50s and going up about a degree every 2 or 3 days. And your normal lows are about 18 to 20 degrees colder than that, so mid 30s or so. Well, last week, and it looks like about the first 10 days of April, running about the second coldest first 10 days of April that we've had in Michigan on record.
Well, and I guess we have to ask, so how much of this, Mark, do we chalk up to climate change, and how much is just normal weather variation?
It's a little of both, and I can't give you the exact percentage of which is which. The one thing that is happening in climate change that I accept is the polar region, the North Pole, is quite a bit warmer than normal. While we have been, like, say, for example, in the early part of April, about 10 degrees or so colder than average, the polar region has been 22 degrees warmer than average. So when you warm that pole up, it's kind of messing up the circulation, and it's driving the normal big pocket of cold off the North Pole and breaking it up into several pieces. And guess what? The most vigorous cold piece is centered over central Canada, dropping down in the U.S. right now. That's a favored place for the cold that's driven off the poles to come to. So that would be kind of your, you know, if you wanted to blame climate change, that would be one piece of it. On the other side of the coin is we have fluctuating weather here in Michigan and the Great Lakes and the northern U.S. And so a big piece of it is we can have an extremely cold stretch any time of the year. We could have a cold stretch in July that's 10 degrees colder than normal. We've had that. We can have warmer than normal. So part of it is just your normal weather pattern of abnormally weird weather around the globe, and we're in the pocket that's abnormally cold right now.
When do you think we're going to get warmer temps that actually hang around?
I can't tell you what you call warmer. Let's talk, when is it going to jump to normal?
Yeah.
Average temperatures or warmer than average? And it's probably going to be another 2 weeks of colder than normal. And it's such a flip-floppy pattern that I don't think a cold April portends what's coming in this summer. We can do a flip-flop and we can go the other way to 10 degrees warmer than normal in this very flip-floppy, for the lack of a better scientific word, flip-floppy type weather pattern. Now, if May should turn out to be much colder than normal, I think that would be a sign of what we have coming probably in part of summer. But right now, I think we're going to do a flip-flop at some point, like we have about every other month for the last 2 years. And I think sometime in May we'll go to warmer than normal, and that might stick into June. So in the end, a cold April may actually be a sign of a nice warm May and June because of the flip-flop.
Mark Torregrossa, MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist. Mark, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, a new film about the Russians who helped the Detroit Red Wings win back-to-back Stanley Cups. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Freep Film Festival opens in Detroit Wednesday with a documentary film that takes us right to the heart of one of the most compelling stories in sports history anywhere. It tells the story of how the players who became known as the Russian Five came to Detroit and to the Red Wings and helped power the team to back-to-back Stanley Cups.
Growing up in America, right or wrong, fair or unfair, we were kind of trained to be those Russians. They're bad people. They're against us. We sort of had that mentality, even me a little bit. But all I was concerned about was, how can I get good world-class players for the Red Wings?
That from Jimmy Devolano is how The Russian Five begins, the first feature-length documentary from Port Huron native Joshua Reel, getting its world premiere this Wednesday night at a sold-out event in Detroit. With us now is director Joshua Reel and Jenny Fedorovich, who's the producer of The Russian Five. Welcome to both of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks for having us.
What was the story, the heart of the story you wanted to tell?
I think for me, the thing that really interested me in this is the adversity, the overcoming adversity, is sort of the testament to the human condition, the spirit to just overcome. I think you go back to, you know, 1982, when the Detroit Red Wings were the Dead Wings, and it starts with Mike Gillich and sort of this vision of, like, let's rebuild this team. And it's sort of a really Detroit story. It, you know, goes back to our motto of, you know, we hope for better things. We'll rebuild from the ashes. And so you have that. And, you know, the Russian players were hoping for better things when they made the difficult decision to come to North America to play. Obviously, the tragedy that happened, and then the team had to rebuild from that as well.
When you think of those names, you think of Sergei Fedorov and Vladimir Konstantinov and Slava Fetisov and Slava Kozlov and Igor Larionov. Wings fans light up when they hear those names. But I don't think until they see this film, people will really understand what was on the line for those men to make that decision. And there was, Jenny, tremendous risk, was there not, for, especially in those early days when the Wings had their eye on Sergei Fedorov. What a risk there was for the players and the people at home in Russia.
It's unbelievable. Honestly, when that story unfolded in the film, and I actually learned the depth of the story, I was scared how they potentially could have made that decision. You know, I left in 1989 around the same time, and we didn't really leave anybody behind. I don't know how they made that decision. Those people could have been killed. Their families could have been threatened. You know, that's a very, very big thing on the line to leave under those circumstances. It was a scary time.
And you do, I'm going to say this, you do such a fantastic job in your film, in The Russian Five, of taking us back to many years by using not just interviews and film footage, but beautifully done artwork and animation that really puts us all in the moment when Jim Leitz from the Red Wings is reaching out to Sergei Fedorov and saying, come here, and that decision. What was behind that choice of let's not just use old footage and old pictures, but that beautiful animation?
Well, you know, obviously there's parts of the story that there isn't any footage. And so actually when Jenny and I first started talking about the film, animation was on the table. And it was this idea of, you know, or the conversation was, is how do we do it differently? And I think we kind of gravitated towards something that was a little bit of a, you know, a comic book, you know, style, but then also with a feel of like the Soviet constructivist collage look, something that's sort of amalgamating the two types, much like the story, you know, where the Russians come to North America and the styles blend.
Absolutely. And so Detroit fans probably remember as Sergei Fedorov becomes the first Russian to arrive at Joe Louis Arena. And then you take us through all the things that it took to get the others to follow, including playing the cancer card to get Vladimir Konstantinov here. I think a lot of fans might not know that story.
Yeah, people don't know. People will not really know most of the stories,
yeah.
Except Sergei's story was kind of publicized when Larry King goes on and says the Russian just defected. But the depth of how they actually got the players out, and, you know, throughout this research, we found the guy that they were bribing in Russia. And guess what? He's still scared. He was too scared to talk to us, even all this time has passed. And the things that they were doing and had to do to get out at that time.
Including a fake doctor's note.
Fake doctor's notes, bribes, whatever it took just to get the players out.
Let's listen to another clip. Jimmy Devolano remembering his first meeting with Vladimir Konstantinov. It happened in the dead of night while the Russian team was in Detroit for an exhibition game.
I said, Vladimir, you're an NHL player. We'd like to have you, and we want you to stay. And he looked at me sadly, and he said, I would like to come, but I have a wife and a daughter. I can't desert them.
Plus, he's a captain in the Russian military. So if he deserted, he'd be considered a felon in Russia, which would make him automatically incapable of getting an H-1 visa to play in the National Hockey League.
I said, I understand, Vladdy. I want you to come over here with your family. We're going to find a way to get to you down the road. Don't forget us.
And then the final touch was getting that fifth player, the professor, Igor Larionov. And that was Scotty Bowman's idea?
It's Scotty Bowman all the way. Scotty Bowman, he's a historian of the game of hockey. I mean, even today, you can ask him, Scotty, who was the third line center of the 1976 Soviet team? And he'll, like that. So Scotty knew, you know, Larionov was the key cog in for them to play the five-man style. But even more importantly, you know, Scotty knew the kind of person Larionov was and the intangibles he would bring to the locker room, the leadership that they needed at that time.
How did these Russians change the way not just the Detroit Red Wings played, but the NHL played?
I think, you know, the NHL is a league where when something's successful, other teams try to copy it. And the puck possession game became the game, and it is today, controlling the puck. You know, if you have the puck on offense, you're not having to play defense. And so then it becomes sort of a system. And, you know, to this day, the teams that go deep in the playoffs are the teams playing, you know, puck possession. Mm-hmm. You look at Steve Yzerman in Tampa Bay, he's got Russians and they're playing the system. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that was the influence of him spending time with the Russian Five.
And I believe the first commentary was, it's watching ballet on ice.
Yes.
So, and we're known for both, right?
Yes, indeed. Well, your film raises something that I think a lot of folks have forgotten in the afterglow of those back-to-back Stanley Cup wins, that not everyone was happy to see the Russians on the ice. This is a moment with Jimmy Devolano talking about getting grief from a longtime friend.
He said, what are you doing bringing all these Russians over? They're going to take my job. I'm a Canadian. I've worked all my life. And this person's still a friend of mine today. Good guy. Good guy. But he gave me hell for drafting all these Russians.
And then this from Steve Yzerman.
The ideology is different. Their values are different. It's just they grew up in a different system. And as a result, they thought differently than us.
So what did you learn in talking to all of these people who were part of this story about what it took to kind of merge them together and to make the Russian Five a part of the Red Wings and vice versa, kind of embrace each other?
Yeah, you know, Brian Murray talks about it in the interview where these guys were good guys. You know, they were good people off the ice. They were good people on the ice. So that certainly helped ingratiate them within the locker room. But the National Hockey League, it's professional sports. At the end of the day, you're trying to win. So if these guys can help you win, they're going to be accepted a lot quicker. And the talent level that Yzerman and Konstantinov and even Slava Kozlov brought, I really think helped them be, you know, a part of the locker room. You know, but there's still struggle. And what we found out is it wasn't until Slava Fetisov came along that the personalities of the three young Russians started to kind of open up.
And why was that?
I think, you know, there's just language and culture. You know, it, obviously Fedorov took to the culture quickly. You know, but Vladdy had a wife and a daughter at home, so he's not going out, you know, with the guys as much.
And Slava Kozlov, it's telling that his interview is in Russian. He didn't, everybody knew he didn't really take to learning English. He was not Igor Larionov.
Correct. Yeah. You know, Kazi was great. You know, and the one line of English that he spoke in the whole interview was, you know, I think my English is worse than Russian Five. So it didn't make the cut, but I think it says a lot, you know.
I'm wondering, and Jenny, you know, your own experience as an immigrant from Russia, how much of that resistance do you think may have stemmed from what we heard Jimmy Devolano speak at the beginning, that kind of baked in suspicion and mistrust between the two countries?
Well, I mean, ever since we were children in Russia, just like he was talking about Russians were bad people, we were taught Americans are really bad people, really, really bad people. And I think when you grow up listening to that, you're a very, very guarded person because it's just ingrained in your brain, right? Mm-hmm. And then you end up here, of course you're going to be guarded. It's a different culture. We didn't understand that. So, of course, they were very guarded based on the fact that where they came from. And they came here to do the job and they were not sure what are the American customs, how to communicate necessarily with the people on your team. So I think when they came together, that was a great thing for them.
And it finally did happen June 7th, 1997, that night to remember when the Wings swept the Flyers and won their first Stanley Cup in 42 years. You could not have scripted a better story arc, could you? I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up.
Oh, no. I mean, as we were laying out the arc in the edit, I mean, it just sort of, you know, it really, my job was to just get out of the way of the story and just let it kind of unfold and then just find the emotional beats.
Here's Igor Larionov, followed by Slava Kozlov, talking with sports reporter Ray Lane.
The happiest day in my life. I've been playing hockey for 30 years. It's a great trophy. And I'm so happy for everybody and for this town of Detroit.
Very happy for my teammates. They helped me win Stanley Cup. And now I feel very good.
Well, we'll say thank you to you, partner, for your great play, for being a big part of it. Congratulations.
Thanks, sir.
And have a great summer, okay?
Okay, thanks.
But the happiness did not last. Just a week later came the limousine accident. Just to refresh everyone's memories, or people who perhaps were not in Detroit in 1997 when this happened, what happened that night?
You know, it was the last day of the celebrations. They had spent 6 days together. Everyone was preparing to go off in their own directions. You know, some of the Russian guys were going to go to Russia. Nick Lidstrom was going to go to Sweden. Scotty Bowman had actually left for Buffalo. So they spent the day out at the golf outing. And then Vladdy and Slava Fetisov and Sergei Manatsakhanov, the team masseur, they retired, you know. And so they said, we're going to leave early. And they all got into a limo and left. And then the limousine driver fell asleep and he crashed the limo into a tree. And, you know, Vladdy suffered brain torsion and he was in a coma for 2 months. We weren't sure if he was going to live or die. And that was, you know, it was a really hard time. And, you know, I remember I was maybe 13 or so, 14. That summer, it just, there was a cloud over it in the whole city, I think. And
there was.
It really took the wind out of our sails.
I was working at Channel 50 and we carried the Red Wings games. And I remember covering that story and it just... The stunning juxtaposition of the joy and the huge victory parade down Woodward Avenue to Hart Plaza just days earlier, and then this immense tragedy. And one of the things I really want to credit your film for doing was showing us the funny human side of Vladimir Konstantinov, that I think a lot of people, if they just saw him on the ice, thought of him as this big man mountain, a funny, warm, wonderful guy.
Absolutely. He is that, and it's just, it's great that we were able to get some of that footage when he's impersonating
the Terminator.
Yes, you know, yes. Playing a guitar and just those warm moments. And, you know, he was very well loved and very well known in the Russian community as well. They would often go with us. We actually played soccer together. They played with just regular people. I mean, all around, just great guy. And what a tragedy. They did everything right. They had a driver, and it's just...
They did. And I'm interested, as you talked, and, you know, sat down, Joshua, and interviewed virtually everybody that had a part in that win, from four of the five Russians to Scotty Bowman to players. You got Yzerman and Shanahan and Chris Osgood and McCarty and Draper, on and on. How much does that accident and talking about that still get to them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I learned actually to stop structuring my interview chronologically, because as we got closer and closer, I would notice that the guys would get more tense as they realized this, oh, we're about to talk about this. So, yeah, I kind of had to change that up a little bit. It still affects guys. I mean, Sergei Fedorov, he refused to talk about it. And so he said, you know, no, I'm not going to talk about it. So I was like, well, can you talk about the fans' response to that, you know, with the memorials they made? And he started talking about that, and he started to crack open the door, and he started to show a little bit of emotion, and then he slammed it shut again. He was like, nope, sorry, guys, that's it. I mean, this is 20 years later, and it still affects them.
What most surprised you in telling the story? And, Jenny, I'm going to start with you. You grew up knowing so many of these guys were heroes to what used to be the Soviet Union and then Russia. What surprised you the most as you dug into this story?
I think what surprised me the most is actually how they all ended up here, because that story is extremely unknown, even to the Russian people. So I think that's going to be a very interesting part of the story, because I've lived through the wins. I was at the games, you know, so there's really no surprise there. I was at the parade with a million people. But I think the front end of the story really surprised me of how they actually ended up here.
Yes, it's great. And having Jim Leitz, who had been the Red Wings executive at the time, who was part of that, was so key to taking us there. What about your biggest surprise?
I think for me, it was the intangibles that the older Russians, Larionov and Fetisov, brought to the team that you don't get when you're watching the games. You don't get as a fan to realize that the culture shift in the locker room as these guys came in. You know, we already had probably the greatest captain in the history of the NHL in Steve Yzerman, so you don't think that there's a leadership vacuum, and there's not, but when you've encountered so many difficult losses, having that sort of leadership of these two guys who struggled to get out of the Soviet Union but said, we're going to do it the right way. We're not going to defect. We're going to stand up for our rights. You know, years later, I guess 7, 8 years later, you know, now they're leading the team in different ways. You know, the chemistry is changing, and they're teaching guys things. And the season that they won the Stanley Cup, the Russians took the team out to a big Russian dinner. And it was this moment where they all just came together as one. And Chris Osgood, you know, talks about it. He's like, you know, it's not about the jersey. It's not about the name on the jersey. It's not about where you come. We're just all a bunch of guys trying to win a big silver trophy.
It is a story that it isn't just for hockey fans. It is for people who care about heart, and just an incredible story. And I will say, having watched it, you will want your Kleenex. There are some very powerful, beautiful moments in this. Well, the film is going to get its world premiere. The Russian Five gets its world premiere at a sold-out event this week at the Free Film Festival. There's another sold-out event. You might still get tickets for a screening Friday at the DIA. Where else might people get a chance to see your film?
We're still trying to figure that out now, but if they go to our website, therussian5.com, they can sign up for updates, and we'll hopefully have some pretty soon.
Producer Jenny Fedorovich and director Joshua Real, congratulations on The Russian Five.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. After the break, we check in on the Democratic race for governor. Every day for the rest of this week, we'll feature an interview with one of the four candidates. First up, former Xerox Vice President Bill Cobbs. That's in 7 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for another edition of Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here now with a look at productions from professional theater companies all over the state. And this time around, a mix of preview and review, because you and your team have been really busy seeing plays.
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic this week, maybe more so than usual, and a bit tired. We just had 8 shows that we've reviewed over this last weekend going back to Thursday, which included a trip up to Alpena to see the folks at Thunder Bay. We previewed their production of The Odd Couple last time I was here. And it was quite interesting, including some wrinkles on the casting, having a woman be one of the poker players.
Okay.
That was interesting. But yeah, so the first review that we'll do this week, the Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea just opened a new play. It's a world premiere called Sherlock Holmes and the Adventure of the Elusive Ear. And this is a new play by playwright David McGregor, who works right here in Michigan, and who has had other plays performed at the Rose, as well as other theaters around the country. McGregor wrote this play out of research he was already doing on a book. And I talked to David this week about how this play came to be.
I always wanted to write a Sherlock Holmes play, and I was working on a nonfiction book on Sherlock Holmes and realized I was already immersed in that world, and there would be no better time than to work on the play as well. And so I kind of worked on both simultaneously, and the play was kind of an escape from the book in that I could just make things up and have fun with it and try to create something exciting for play watchers.
This is a really cool adaptation he did. You got Vincent van Gogh is in the story. Oscar Wilde is in the story. And as the title suggests, and I just referenced Vincent van Gogh, The Adventure of the Elusive Ear. So maybe your listeners can draw the connection that way.
There you go. Over to the Matrix Theater in Detroit for a play called Kayak.
Yeah, this is a fascinating play about a suburban mother. And she's played by a terrific actress named Kez Settle. She acts locally. The mom in the whole play, she's in a kayak in the middle of the stage, and she's in a kind of remembrance about the relationship between her only son and his girlfriend and the relationship between her son and herself. This is a play I've seen before in another city, and it does a beautiful job, I think, of bringing to life the conflicts between generations, baby boomer parents and their millennial children. Dialogue in the story and the play is only about an hour, no intermission. It's exceptional.
All right, now we're going to a somewhat larger stage over to Midtown Detroit, to the Fisher Theater.
Right, we've got the Broadway in Detroit series, The School of Rock, is coming this week. This is the musical adapted from the film. The show's been a huge success on Broadway, where it's still playing. It's funny, it's charming, and it's got good tunes like this one. When I climbed to the top of Mount Rock, and I perched at the uppermost peak, with a legion of groupies all taking it out for my chiseled rock god physique. And I'll scatter hit singles all over the land with my 12 Grammys in hand. Watch the fanboy
top of Mount Rock.
And that is, of course, from the original cast recording of School of Rock. So if you got a kick out of the Jack Black film, you're going to like the theatrical version?
Very much so.
Very much so. Now to Oakland County, to West Bloomfield and the Jewish Ensemble Theater.
Right. This is a theater, if you haven't been to it, it's housed in the Berman Center for Performing Arts. This is the Michigan premiere of a play called Hard Love, and it's about two ultra-Orthodox newlyweds who are forced to divorce when the husband turns his back on the religion. 25 years later, their children from second marriages, they fall in love, and the parents reconnect to discuss their children's problematic relationship. The story is extremely well written. So this story, which is known as The Jet, has a mission similar to another rep theater we often talk about, the Detroit Rep. That theater is committed to plays that have a thread or a message or theme about race relations or civil rights. The Jet explores religious themes in its plays, conflict, humor around religion, always with some angle on Judaism, either stories within Judaism like this one or stories that depict or center on relationships among Jews and people of other religions. I don't want to give anybody the idea that these plays are propaganda or preachy. This is a theater that regularly produces absolutely wonderful work, edgy work, and it attracts some of the best talent in the area.
So it's work that speaks to everyone beyond being Jewish.
Absolutely. I've seen, you know, I'm not Jewish. I've seen several shows there. It's all top-notch work. It's a beautiful theater, performance space. It's actually a theater that's under the main performance space at the Berman Center.
There we go. Lots on offer, and you can get details of these and other productions by going to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Next Sunday, Michigan's Democrats will be gathering in Detroit for their 2018 state endorsement convention. They'll be endorsing a candidate for attorney general, one for secretary of state, and candidates for the state Supreme Court. And it seemed like a good time to check back in with the Democratic candidates for Michigan's governor, what with the primary less than 4 months away. And today we begin with Bill Cobbs, formerly the global vice president for Xerox. And it is a pleasure to welcome you back to Stateside,
Bill. Thank
you,
Cindy. I appreciate it.
Let's plunge right into some of the big headline issues
Sure.
for Michigan and for the country. And we'll start with guns. What do you feel you would do to make Michigan schools safer in the face of mass shootings?
Well, clearly, you know, we've got to step back and realize that the Second Amendment does not mean that there is no regulation. And we've got to really be focused on responsible gun ownership. And I think it's time that we take a very close look at the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction.
These assault weapons.
Assault weapons.
Yeah.
And really ask ourselves, do we want those kind of weapons in the hands of ordinary citizens? They were never meant to be off the battlefield. And clearly, we've seen time after time after time where they've been used in these kind of incidents, like what happened in Parkland. And, you know, we can't continue to march down the same path and see the same results and not realize that we need to do something different.
And how do you sell that message to people who fear that any kind of action is infringing on their Second Amendment rights?
Well, you know, as an individual that went to law school, I can tell you that this notion that we have that the Constitution is a static document never meant to change with time is long past rethinking. We have to realize that when the Founding Fathers created the Constitution and the Second Amendment, they never envisioned a time when we would have the kind of firepower that we have today. And I don't think that if any of them were alive today, that they would be supporting these kind of weapons in ordinary citizens' hands.
Let's go over to water. What are your thoughts on the Nestle permit?
I think it's a travesty. I think when you have 80,000 Michigan citizens saying no and less than 20 saying yes, that it's time for the government, it's time for MDEQ to recognize that they're there to serve the people of the state, not private business and not big individuals who want to use our public resources to fill their pockets. And that's what Nestle is all about. You know, we're living in a world today where water every single day becomes a more precious resource. And to allow anyone to come into the state of Michigan with the biggest straw they can find and stick it in the ground and say, you know, have at it, while we have citizens in Flint who are still afraid to use their water, we have folks in Detroit who are getting shut off because they can't afford to pay a water bill. They got to make a decision about paying their rent or paying for the water. We need to rethink our approach to how we deal with this resource in the state.
Governor Snyder's spokesperson told us the law says that decision to let Nestle extract more water at a cost of that $200 a year permit is the DEQ's, and he will not be getting involved. Do you agree with that?
Well, clearly, the governor and I have a different perspective. You know, I respect the first line of the Michigan Constitution that says that all political power is inherent in the people, that government is for their equal benefit, security, and protection. Now, clearly, some people in Lansing don't understand that, and it's time that we either give them a very, very long vacation or we change our Constitution. I'm in favor of giving them a vacation.
Let's shift over to schools. Recent study showed that Michigan third grade reading scores were abysmal. They are just about dead last of the 50 states. What would you do to improve Michigan schools?
So I have said that until we are prepared to fund our schools properly, we are kidding ourselves if we say that we're serious about doing anything that's going to impact the school-to-prison pipeline. I am proposing equalized state funding. It's time to move away from Proposal A and provide for equalized funding for every kid in the state. We're underfunding public education in Michigan by thousands of dollars. The number that we really need to get to is about $11,500 per student. That's reasonable to me. We live in a state where we're paying $41,000 a year to keep people incarcerated. We got to really think about how we're spending our money and what the end result is that we're shooting for. We can do much better. And education has always been the only gateway in this country to social and economic mobility. If we're not serious about making sure that all of our young people have an equal opportunity for a good education, then we're kidding ourselves about being the country we say we are.
So that target, $11,500 per student, is what you see.
Yeah.
Where do you see charter schools in this vision? Are they providing a viable option for families, as supporters argue, or are they draining students and dollars from public schools?
So here's my take on this. There are people in this race who have said that they would outlaw charter schools. I don't know how you do that. But I can tell you that as the next governor of the state, my intent is to defund them so that they're not eligible for public dollars, because taxpayers never intended that their money would be used to support private enterprise. You know, one of the challenges that we have is creating this notion that it's better to set up a different school environment than to work on the ones that we have and make them better. You know, schools are really the primary anchor for every single community. When you take the school out of a community or you disadvantage to the point where it has to close, you literally begin the erosion of the fabric of that community. It's the beginning of blight. And once blight starts, you start to have houses that are vacant. We can do so much better. Right now, we have an state educational budget of about $12.2 billion. Over $1 billion of that now is going into private charters' pockets. Just imagine what we could accomplish if we redirected that money back into our public school system.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Bill Cobbs, Democratic candidate for governor, exploring a lot of issues facing Michigan. Roads and infrastructure, certainly one of the big challenges we're facing in this state, the condition of them, and finding enough money to fix what needs fixing. What ideas are shaping up in your mind to meet this problem?
So I have had a fully formed infrastructure plan from the day I entered this race, and it's a radical plan. It involves us investing $60 billion in infrastructure. We would do that by floating a 30-year municipal bond. We need to make massive investments in our infrastructure and start from one side of the state and go to the other. We can't continue down this path and not appreciate the impact we're going to have on the quality of life for every single citizen in the state. And if we're really, really serious about being attractive to more business, we've got to have an infrastructure model that supports that. Nobody's going to come to Michigan and build facilities to manufacture a product or to deliver a product if we don't have good infrastructure to support their getting those products to market. It's just common sense. We have tons of work to do. We have a situation right now where we're of the belief that we can fix this problem by patching it every year, and patching doesn't work. I had the opportunity in my career to spend some time in Denmark, a country that has far worse weather conditions than Michigan has, and they had roads that lasted for 25 plus years. We can do that here if we're willing to make the right investments.
It is looking, Bill, more and more likely that whomever is elected as Michigan's next governor is going to be presiding over economic downturn. Some economists even predict recession. What are your thoughts as to how you'd handle that?
So there's no question that by the time we reach the fourth quarter of next year, whatever is happening in the business world, Michigan will be facing a fiscal crisis because of the way that we've used our resources. We've kind of put ourselves in a hole by giving out massive amounts of corporate welfare and not understanding that the return that we're saying we're going to get is a guess. There's no guarantee. And so we're going to have to make some adjustments. Now, as the next governor of the state, I vowed that we're not going to cut services to citizens. What we need to do is to really put together a 21st century tax policy, a tax policy that looks at where the resources are and makes sure that everybody's paying their fair share. Doesn't make sense in Michigan that we have citizens who make $20,000 a year paying the same tax rate as folks who make millions of dollars. So I've said that one of the things that I would like to do as the next governor of the state is preside over a constitutional convention that would allow us to modify our state constitution and go from a fixed tax rate to a progressive tax rate. That tax rate would start with the 4.25. People who have a household income of less than $200,000 would still pay 4.25. If you got a household income greater than that, you would pay more. We would have a top nominal tax rate of 10%. To be paying 10%, you would have to earn more than $600,000. I think that's fair. We also need to make sure that our corporations are really paying their fair share. We have a corporate tax rate in Michigan of 6%. But if you can find five corporations that actually pay 6%, I invite you to let us know because we'll take you to dinner wherever you'd like to go. You know, we've got to make sure that we close those loopholes that allow them to escape paying their fair share and have the opportunity to really fundamentally move Michigan forward by investing in all of the things that make us a great state.
Candidates have to turn in at least 15,000 valid signatures by April 24th to get on the ballot. Are you confident you'll hit that?
I'm pretty confident that we won't have any problem. We plan on turning our signatures in on, I believe, the 23rd. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be collecting until the very last day because we want to make sure that we come as close to 30,000 signatures so that we don't have any problems with the signatures we turn in.
Now, recent polling has you below 5%. How do you plan to move that needle?
Well, I got to tell you, Cindy, I don't pay any attention to those polls because one of the things that I understand is that when you do a sampling of 600 people and you're sampling them for one response, whose name have you heard? That's not a representative sample of what's really going on with the people. And then when you put at the very end that 50% of people still don't know anybody, then this is still a very wide open race. And I think that over the next few months, we'll have a real opportunity to determine who the candidates are that really not only have a vision for moving Michigan forward, but can clearly articulate a Democratic message that enables us to beat their likely candidate, Bill Schuette, in November.
Bill Cobbs, candidate for governor from the Democratic Party in Michigan. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and Joey Horan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.